This is author David Helvarg speaking about 50 Ways to Save the Ocean on April 24, 2006. You can find the full speech at forum.wgbh.org. Part 2 of 2.
This is the WGBH Forum Network.
But there are things that every day we don't think about. If you eat, and do what I say, not what I do, if you eat organic and vegetarian food, all that surplus chemicals that's used, the chemical agriculture, is reduced and the runoff is reduced. And in places like California, organic is the largest growing sector of agriculture. Plus, it's also the most supportive. The conservation easements that are part of the farm bill are most applicable to family-based farming. And again, if you're buying local produce, you're supporting a family-based farm, you're also reducing the amount of fossil fuels used in the transport of food. Same with energy, conservation in your home. You know, you have an energy efficient humidifier in winter and you keep your thermostat at 65, the humidifier will make it feel like 72 degrees. Important because in the United States, unlike Western Europe, half our electricity is still generated by coal-fired power plants. Not only the most carbon-rich fossil fuel that's increasing global warming, which is impacting our oceans, but also putting mercury up the smokestacks, and that mercury comes back down into our oceans and back through the food web into our tuna fish sandwiches. Having a non-toxic household, making sure if you're on the green that the golf course is meeting the highest standards, the Audubon Platinum standards of controlling runoff, and some people's yards and playing fields are more pesticide intensive than American agriculture. What we drive counts, and what I'm finding as I was working on the 50 ways is that the things that help the ocean tend to help us as well. Our health, drive a more fuel efficient vehicle, and when you get a chance, walk or bike. Conserve energy, use non-toxic cleaners. Vinegar and borax and things like this are a lot cheaper and a lot less harmful, not only to the ocean but to yourself. Driveways and roofs. I mean, there's an article today in the Boston Globe on, green roofs. The Ford has a factory in Dearborn that has a planting. It's much more common in Europe, but they've planted the roof in turf, native turf, and it absorbs 200 every time there's a storm. 250,000 gallons of water is absorbed and taken off that roof slowly. So they're saving millions in the water retainment system they'd have to create if they didn't have that green roof. More common is your driveway. 1 inch of rain is 900 gallons of runoff from a hardened surface from your driveway. If you use shell or gravel, anything, they now have what they call permeable pavers that you can use for driveways that will run the water back into the soil. Even mowing your grass, leave the blades a little longer, and it reduces compaction of your soil and it provides shade for the roots during droughts. Simple stuff, but it adds up because, as I say, when you pave everything over, I talked to the director of sanitation in L.A. She talks about the first big flush of winter. They paved the L.A. River, and you've got 80 square miles of pavement. And when the first winter rains come, all those pavements, so all the water runs off quick, and it takes along all the spilled oil products and gasoline and dog droppings that weren't picked up by their owners and plastic debris, and it goes down the storm drains and it pops out on the beaches, and you got a 50% greater chance of getting sick if you're swimming within 500 feet of those storm drains. And she says, it took us. She's jealous. She says, I wish our problem was agricultural runoff, because, you can then you're just dealing with cows. She says, I've got like 40 languages in the Los Angeles basin, and I have to like educate people in 40 languages. She says, she thinks it can be done, but it takes a generation. It took us a generation to learn that if we don't use our seat belts, we go through the windshield. took a generation for people to figure if they keep smoking Chesterfield, they're going to die of lung cancer. And it may take a generation to understand that anything we throw out doesn't go away. Anything that goes down that storm drain is going to end up at the beach you want to go swim at this summer. Don't feed the sharks. I mean, you know, if you're a recreational diver, you're already there. So, you know, when I was a kid, we'd go, you know, watch them feed the bears, the black bears at the dump. And people used to go to Yellowstone and feed donuts to the grizzlies. Training wildlife to associate humans with food is not a terribly wise idea. We learned that on land. Mostly it ends up with dead bears, occasionally dead people. Now you've got these recreational shark feeding programs. You know, go out and go with the dive and we'll feed the sharks, and same principle. I mean, you know, people have to be educated. I released some sharks in the Keys as an educational program, but you can't educate everybody. A few days later, this guy went out from his timeshare in Key Largo, and he saw some fins in the water. He thought, oh, cool, I'll go swim with the dolphins. But it was bull sharks. He got bit in the foot, and I was kind and didn't use his name when I wrote it up. You know, there are all these things we can do as consumers, as citizens. I mean, I'm not even sure, you know, we're at a crisis point, and crisis means opportunity. We have an opportunity to convert from fossil fuels to renewable energies, you know, solar photovoltaics and biomass and wind turbines and the hydrogen fuel cells that can act as a storage systems to keep these temporary energy sources and make them into permanent protective sources. And you know, it's a huge challenge. The people who talk about this challenge are people like Sir John Brown, the CEO of BP, no longer British Petroleum, it's now Beyond Petroleum. And he's talking about he just came to the realization, talking to the scientists, that, wait a minute, we're not an oil company, we're an energy company. If we get in on these changing technologies, we'll thrive. Unfortunately, America is now falling behind. America used to be the leading innovators for things like photovoltaics. Now it's Europe, now it's other places. But the opportunities are there, and it's recognition. 150 years ago, if you'd said, we've got to stop whaling, there were, you know, the whale barons here in New Bedford would have said, you're insane. Whale oil is the lubricant of the machine age, and it's lighting our finest homes and streets. And, the economy will collapse without whale oil. And what are you, anti-worker? You're going to put 10,000 whalers out of work, not to mention the guys in subsidiary, into the harpoon makers, the stave makers. Well, whaling ended, and we got into rock oil. And guess what? The economy expanded tremendously. You know, I was out. I was approached by one of the U.S. commissioners, who's an oil company guy. He said, I loved your chapter on offshore oil. And I thought, is that the part where I said we've got to abolish your industry? But no, what he liked was the reality, which is I was out there with these roughnecks and roustabouts, and it's incredible. It's like the world's largest Tinker Toys. You know, whoever designs offshore wells, like, totally utilizes their closet space at home. And I had a great time, but I had a great time like I was on a whaling ship in 1850s. This is a heroic period of American industry whose time has come and gone. It's obsolete now, and we have to move on. And you know, we'll look back in history and we'll say, did we move quick enough? There's moments that are critical, and if we want living seas, if we want to pass down the experience, the sense of joy, of joy and solace that the oceans give to us, and also the sense of danger, then we have to act now. I mean, I like spending years living on a cliff. You know, the waves were like my mother's heartbeat. I never slept better. I like body surfing in what they call the Red Triangle in Northern California. The water's cold, but they're good waves, and Ed Abbey said it best, you know, if there's not something bigger and meaner than you are out there, it's not really wilderness. We still have a wilderness that we can still protect and turn around. I'm not underestimating the dangers. I think that I can't even say that we're going to educate the public and mobilize the political will in time. All I know is if we don't try, we lose. And in the trying, there's something of value. So that's what we have to do. It's you know, it's given us so much, we got to give back. And I think people are ready for that. That's my sense. So thank you, and let me take questions. First question's always, you know. Once it's asked, things roll.
What is the fear of the underworld in Hollywood? Is it at all related to the top?
The fear of the underworld?
Of the undersea world. Pardon the underworld.
You mean like Jaws? Well, we should be afraid of the ocean. We should respect it. I don't think it's our friend or our enemy. I think it's going to remain. The question is it going to remain as a living entity, as a source of life? And Hollywood likes monsters, and out of sight, out of mind is always a good theme for suspense. I mean, Peter Benchley was becoming a friend. He recently passed away. He wrote Jaws because he was looking for a monster. And you can't it's true. There are like 7 people a year die of shark bite every year on this planet, and we kill 100 million sharks. But it's like grizzlies. You can't underestimate this sort of atavistic feeling. We're not that far from the savannah, and the fear of being eaten alive by great predators is something we live with. So Hollywood exploits it. Peter was kind of appalled when he realized that people were taking his movie and turning it into an excuse to go shark hunting and kill Jaws. And he became a shark conservationist. He said, when he was growing up, right here in Narragansett, he said, he'd go fishing, and you couldn't go fishing in Nantucket. Couldn't pull in a swordfish or tuna without a shark taking a bite out of it. He says, in recent years, he'd go diving in Costa Rica, and he found the bottom littered with dead fin sharks, their fins taken off. Basically, shark fin soup's the demand. As China's middle class grows up, there's this demand for this tasteless, kind of unpleasant soup, but it's so expensive that it's a status symbol to serve it at your daughter's wedding or what have you. And so Jackie Chan is now doing public service announcements in Hong Kong and elsewhere in China saying, sharks are better in the water. My friend, 50 Ways is illustrated by Jim Toomey. He's a good friend. He has Sherman's Lagoon. I don't know if it runs in the Globe, but it runs in about 200 newspapers around the U.S. And one of the panels, he has Sherman, who's a shark, and his hermit crab friend saying, I've got a class study. What can you use shark fin skin for? He says, well, sandpaper, boots. Fine. Well, you can wrap a shark in it. Hollywood is... Hollywood is Hollywood, and I've got a chapter, immerse in blue media. I think a lot of us grew up on things like that were positive, Jacques Cousteau specials and Sea Hunt. I mean, I certainly, as a kid, my sister and I would, watch it in black and white. It was kind of a mysterious Sea Hunt, Mike Nelson, underwater investigator. I eventually became a diver and a private investigator, I think, largely a result. And there's a certain generation of marine biologists and aquarists you'll find who all watched Sea Hunt. And one of the things is, solutions is just, sit down and talk with your friends or family. What's the blue media that's impacted? Was it 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea? Was it Blue Crush? Was it Endless Summer? It's all our culture has been maritime in a lot of ways, from Hula to the Beach Boys. And, go pull out an old DVD of Cousteau's and watch it with your kids.
I have a question about, you were talking about the runoff. I
the effects in the ocean of nutrient runoff and pollution. Obviously, you know, as you say, all water's connected. And we're seeing, you know, some of the health impacts we're seeing, we saw years ago in the late 1990s with Fisteria, which is, you know, what they call the cell from hell. You feed enough, excuse the term, chicken shit into the Chesapeake Bay, and in the presence of high nutrient environment, it has like 24 life cycles. Four of them are like cannibalistic. They'd come up and they'd literally eat the flesh off of fish. And you're now seeing health impacts from red tides, which are aerosolating. You're seeing people who are having serious skin rashes in the Chesapeake right now. They're calling it fisherman's disease. What we just had in Hawaii, which I think is probably a lot more significant than the latest, you know, cable crime report. There's been historic rains this past few months in both California and Hawaii. It's overflowed. The sewage system in Honolulu has overflowed. There's a guy who, 2 weeks ago, investment banker got in a fight. Somebody threw him in the Alawi Canal that feeds out to Waikiki. He came out of it within 24 hours. He was in the hospital with flesh-eating bacterial infections, lost a leg, and before they had to do any more amputations, he passed away. He died. This is the kind of, you know, here at Harvard Medical, you've got Paul Epstein and other researchers looking at the human health impacts of changing oceans, which includes everything from increased HABs, harmful algal blooms. There's normal red tides, but we've seen an increase in the numbers in recent years, and we've seen them showing up in places like Oregon and Alaska. We've never seen them before. And it's all, I think it's largely the nutrient-based releases. The Chesapeake Compact is a voluntary agreement between the states that's supposed to reduce nutrient input into the bay. And the Washington Post did an expose last year because the compact people said, well, we've reduced nutrient runoff 40%. He says, well, why is the bay dying? Why are the seagrasses all going moldy and the oysters all dying? So they went with USGS that actually have the stuff in the water, the CT scans and stuff, and found that there'd been no nutrient reduction. It was what the states were calling an overly optimistic computer model they were using. So voluntary programs may not be enough. We may have to get serious about reducing all the wastes and regulating. We've done it before. We regulated with the Clean Water Act in the 1970s, and it worked. You know, we reduced point source of pollution. We told factories they can no longer dump their effluent into the river and the lake. And we told municipalities they could no longer dump their sewage without treatment. We have to start applying that to all these wide non-source sources of runoff, which is why we need to talk about our own lives and look at them. How do we control our own, you know, urban development? And people are doing it. I mean, in Connecticut, they've got developments where it's all impermeable. In Key West now, there's a tax on concrete surfaces. So now you have all the banks that are like taking out their concrete parking lots and putting in shell lots, or you know, they tax themselves a bond, and they tore out the sewage lines and they put in advanced treatment sewage, you know, that strips the nutrients out, protects the coral reefs. I first went down there and started working with this group Reef Relief 10 years ago. I was filming a PBS segment called Green Means, and we're on the bridge of the Reef Relief boat filming a NOAA diver at the sewage outfall at the edge of the city. He had a Mark V helmet on, a full dry suit. He was taping himself with gaffer's tape. He went down there, he took his samples. When he came out, he had like a solution of betadine that he was pouring over himself. Last summer, I was snorkeling in that same spot. You know, 10 years later, it's a snorkel park. You're seeing a lot of soft corals, big groupers and tarpons coming in there. So we can, you know, there's tremendous resilience in the ocean. And if we do it, we can bring it back. If we create, you know, big marine protected areas, no take zones, you know, no hooks, no drilling, no diving, you take only pictures, you leave only bubbles, and the fish come back, which is what we need. You know, we stop killing fish, fish will tend to come back. We're realizing that the places that are protected, the bigger and the longer they're protected, the more healthy they become, and the more interesting, the more wildlike the habitats. Mark Hixson's a scientist I met in Oregon. He came up with the term old fat females. It's what you want in the ocean. You want old fat female fish because their eggs are more viable. They produce more of them. You get abundance comes back more quickly. You take out the big fish, you don't know what you're doing. We thought we knew what we were doing. We'd say, if you take the big fish, then the small fish will grow out. It's fine. Groupers are transsexuals. So you take the big groupers out and the small females can't mate. I did a piece, the Reverend Dobson condemned SpongeBob SquarePants as promoting the homosexual lifestyle. Say he doesn't know the half of it. Most sponges are hermaphrodites. You know, sea otters are into rough sex. I mean, you know, there are incredible variety of reproductive strategies in the ocean, and the only real sin is that we're taking them out faster than they can do their thing.
This is author David Helvarg speaking about 50 Ways to Save the Ocean on April 24, 2006. You can find the full speech at forum.wgbh.org, part 2 of 2.